Greetings, everyone, and welcome back to the Mark Fraley Podcast. Today is Friday, November 15, 2019. Nashville is on the rebound from a cold snap we had earlier this week. We officially had our first hard freeze. At our house, we were lucky enough to get some last-minute cleanup done before the garden sets in for the winter. Hopefully, it'll be warm enough this weekend to do just a little bit more. Yesterday, I was privileged to sit down and have a fun and wide-ranging conversation with my old friend Mike Berkeley. Mike and his wife Terry Barnes are the proprietors of Grow Wild Nursery in Fairview, Tennessee. They are specialists in native plants. Grow Wild Nursery has become one of the favored and trusted suppliers of native trees, shrub, grasses, and vines in our region. They have been prominent in such projects as the Clinton Library, Green Roof, and the Cora Howe Garden at Cheekwood. As a nurseryman, Mike is truly among America's most preeminent experts in native plant gardening. This is his second appearance on the Mark Fraley Podcast. He visited us about 2 years ago when we spoke in depth about invasive exotic plants. Yesterday, we spoke about grasses and grass-like plants and about how they can be incorporated into home landscapes. Listeners may want to have a pen and paper handy to take notes about his plant recommendations. As you will hear, he has an encyclopedic knowledge. Regular listeners to this podcast will know that I usually begin interviews by conducting a biographical sketch of my guest. In today's podcast, I've omitted that, inasmuch as Mike had provided a lot of detail about his education and upbringing in our previous interview. That interview can be found in the archives section of the podcast website, and that was March of 2018. And so, I hope you'll enjoy my conversation with Mike Berkeley. So, Mike Berkeley, welcome to the Mark Fraley Podcast.
Oh, Mark, good to be here.
I should say welcome back to the Mark Fraley
yeah,
Podcast.
Yeah, it's good to be back. Yeah, so, this is fun.
So, Mike, you were my guest here on one of the very first of my programs, maybe in the very first six or so of the programs, about 2 years ago. Yeah. And I would encourage listeners to go back and listen to that session, that podcast that we had a couple years ago. It is still today statistically the highest ranking podcast that I have done.
Well, you know, Mark, I have a big family out there around Middle Tennessee, and all my cousins must keep listening to it or something, because that's your popularity there.
We have over 900 downloads for that session a couple of years ago that we did about invasive exotic plants.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah. And that was very dear to both of us.
Exactly.
To our hearts.
Yeah. You had appeared courtesy of the Tennessee Invasive Plant Council.
Right.
And so today I wanted to bring you back and talk about grass. We're not talking about the kind you smoke.
That's another show, I guess.
That's another show, perhaps. But grasses have become a whole lot more popular.
Oh yeah,
for gardeners.
Oh yeah,
and so I wanted to talk about that today, and explore that subject just generally. But I guess we got to talk about lawns versus what we're talking about here today.
Yeah, because you know, and Mark, you know, we've talked about this before. Is that you talk about grass, and the first thing people think of is the turf grass,
right?
Our lawns, you know, which is pretty non-native, sterile. But we were born and raised with that. And I think what's been really interesting in the native plant movement here in the past few years is that people are willing to do something about that. We're born and raised with turf grass. I can't imagine playing ball or playing with my dog on anything but turf grass, you know. And I didn't realize until later, after Doug Tallamy's book came out, you know, Bringing Nature Home, and talking about, God, do we really need something that's as sterile in our landscapes as the lawn is. So the next thing you know, we're talking about cutting back on the amount of lawn that we have. We're talking about, well, are there native plant substitutes for our lawn? And, you know, so grasses, native grasses are hot right now, because that was the main focus, was, okay, well, what can I use instead? And then the native grasses, even your tall, billowy grasses, are what we call the landscaping grasses that you put in your beds, are really taking another world now. So what we're seeing is that it's okay to use something that's not just a flowering plant or static. And, you know, and I think that's where all native grasses are going now. As far as the turf grass, it's been one of the hardest things. We have experimented for about 20 years now with native grasses for turf substitute. We know, especially around Middle Tennessee, fescue is the preferred grass, and of course it's a Eurasian species. It's a cool season grass. That's why we like it. It's that it's green in the winter, especially right nowadays. And then there's the Bermuda, the other, the zoysias, the warm season grasses. How do we mimic that so that the mainstream buyer out there can find a tall fescue substitute? Well, in full sun and with tall fescue, there's really not. And the reason I say this is that, you know, we could try sedges. I love the sedges. That's the Carex, C-A-R-E-X right genus. And there's about 300 species of Carex in the eastern United States. And every one of them are great.
Right.
But seed production, like a tall fescue would do?
They're not going to hold up to, you know, weekly lawnmower.
No, they're not really right good in mowing. They don't. Right. They're not that mat forming. Although some of them are clumpers, you know, but they don't spread by seeds. That means that they don't produce a lot of seeds. So you look on the back of a bag of a tall fescue blend, or you just go to a box store and look at seed, origin of seed, and it's going to say Oregon. Okay. And up there in Oregon, they've got the perfect weather, perfect soils, perfect conditions to grow thousands of acres of fescue to sell to the rest of the world. And, that's because they produce a lot of seed. Fescue will produce. That's why you see it reseeding itself in natural areas. And okay, it's kind of an invasive non-native species, and especially in open prairie areas. But you don't get, you know, you're not going to get that kind of seed off of some of these native turf grass substitutes. So we look at, okay, what can we do to put in a native lawn? We've toyed around with St. Augustine. Now, here's what's happening. Some of these turf grasses, or native turf grasses, that we know will work further south did not perform as well here because we used to have reliably hard winters. We're not getting reliably hard winters.
Right.
So St. Augustine, which is, I mean, remember, you know, you go to Florida and you're walking around on someone's turf grass and it had a little rough texture to it, and, you know, I thought, wow, well, that's
but it's a native grass.
It's a native grass.
And I actually have seen that in lawns in Memphis. So you have the Southwest Tennessee where it tends to be a little warmer, and it can tolerate
and
a little bit of cold that it gets.
I think it's going to happen here. It is a warm season grass, and you will still have the dormancy in the winter with that, like Bermuda and zoysia.
Right.
But I love the way, and it spreads by runners.
Right.
But I like the texture on it.
Okay? Is it as invasive as the Bermuda is?
You know, I think it's, I don't say it's invasive. I will call it more aggressive.
Okay.
Anytime you get something that runs by rhizomes, okay,
right,
you know, it's going to go into your bed. All right. So when someone says, well, my Bermuda keeps encroaching into the edge of my bed, my work bed, okay? Well, that's that rhizome that's doing
that's
that.
Right.
That's how it spreads.
That's right.
Zoysia will do that,
okay?
But it is a native grass.
And now, St. Augustine will do that.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. St. Augustine will do that. Buffalo grass, I think, has got a lot of promise. But back in the day, buffalo grass didn't perform well here in Middle Tennessee because it was not just a heat issue, it was a humidity and heat issue. So I think that's got a lot of promise. I think experimentation is going to be the key.
So I guess ecologically, we though want to encourage people to maintain as little turf grass
correct
as the, you know, they can. I mean, it's I know in our yard we've reduced by half the amount of lawn that we've done.
Your yard is absolutely spectacular, Mark, and you know, we can walk around in your yard and we can walk on some turf grass.
Right.
But what we're doing is walking in between beds, which I think is just perfect. You know,
right.
Why we need corner to corner, wall to wall, house to street lawns, perfect lawns. It's just I don't understand it. But the design idea is to break up these beds by having a small strip of 2-3 foot wide turf, okay? And the beauty of that in landscaping is I feel like for years and years, we have as gardeners in our yards looked at our landscape from the outside in. By putting these lawn strips, by breaking up the lawn, doing away with some of it, and having lawn strips as walkways through our landscapes, we are becoming more intimate with our landscape.
Exactly.
We're getting in the landscape.
Exactly.
So using, now I'm saying, okay, well, let's not use turf grass, you know, in our yards for a football field. Let's use turf grass to travel through our landscape.
Exactly. You know, so. You know, and people are using clover and that sort of thing to add a little ecological value to an existing lawn.
That's correct.
So if you happen to have a fescue lawn, fine. Overseed it with a little clover.
Yeah. I ask my clients a lot of times, and they'll talk about, well, you know, well, what can we do here in this yard? And I looked where right now in June, if you were, you know, looking at it in June, where's your bees? Where's your pollinators? Where's your butterflies? Where, you know, and fescue does not do anything for that. And except for a robin every now and then, you don't see much of the birds either. So I say, well, even though clover is not native, that you know, the white clover is what most people are using, at least have that mixed in as a mosaic with
right.
your, and it's attractive. You got the white flowers, but the pollinators are there.
Love it.
You know, the bees
right.
love it. So,
right.
you know, it's these little steps, Mark, I think is what we're talking about here, is that, you know, 20 years ago, I could not talk about doing away with lawn. I mean, people would hate me, you know. Now it's like, okay, we can do it, but you take these little steps. All right, it's a big psychological hit for us, okay, to, you know, do away with that lawn. So just, okay, instead of all fescue, throw in some clover.
Right.
Next thing you know, start cutting back a little bit.
Right.
Lawn. So
right.
we talk about the phase 54 a lot and joking, you know, a lot of our clients is that you can't go to the suburban gardener, the homeowner, and say, this is what you got to do.
Exactly.
We are very rebellious about that. Don't tell me what I can and cannot do in my yard. Let them take it on just a little bit at a time. So if clover, and I've been promoting clover a lot, if I go into a sterile lawn environment, I said, well, let's throw some clover down. And then if you like that, then let's talk about what's the next step. And that's curtailing a little bit of that.
Right,
that
exactly. All right. So you and I were talking earlier, and I said to you that I think that gardening is nature study. So where do our native grasses occur out there in the natural world? And what can we learn from that as gardeners?
You know, this has been really fun. And I have to say, sometimes I feel guilty because I'm in the native plant business. And one of the things I have to do is to go out there and see where they grow. You know, wow, what bad luck that is in the state of Tennessee. A beautiful area where I can go out and see where these plants are. And with the grasses, because they're becoming our grasses and the sedges, and we want to have a little separation with
sure.
those. But it's to see where they naturally occur. It's just been amazing. And the big thing is the adaptability of a lot of these grasses and sedges. So with the cedar glades east, southeast of Nashville, to the barrens that occurs over on the other side of the Tennessee River, Carroll Cabin Barrens.
These are native grasslands.
These are native grasslands. These are grasslands. You go to, of course, the prairies, May Prairie. You can go to the river scours up on the Cumberland Plateau or around the Big South Fork. The meadows like we have on our property, and actually a meadow that was formed by beavers, okay? And it's a moist area. It's like taking a prairie but with a little moisture. Hmm. You had Dr. Duane Estes from Austin Peay on a show. You talk with Duane, and it's like, okay, grasslands are everywhere.
Then we have the savanna-type ecology, where you have the large oaks and very few trees, but grass underneath.
Right, right. And then in those, go into those, I call them coppices, they're islands, okay, of these wooded areas, and they're not in full sun. And a little blue stem, which is our predominant grass for the open prairie areas, you're not going to find a little blue stem performing or maybe even surviving in those shady areas. What you're going to see is the shade grasses all of a sudden, and you're going to see the sedges, okay? So, from every plant community you're walking through this side of a wetland, you're walking through a lot of grasses and the sedges.
Right.
And that's what's really been fun, is to take some of these these new plants for us. It used to be it had to be coneflowers or had to be the native azaleas and dogwoods and redbuds. And now the gardener, the average gardener out there is saying, well, show me something different. And the different is these ground covers, that are doing so well in those dry shades and been there for a thousand years, performing as a ground cover. And the textures, some of these sedges are evergreen, and you get that green texture. One of my favorite monkey grass substitutes, and we know about
there
monkey
we
grass.
There we go.
You know about monkey grass.
Right.
I mean, it can be very.
It's like communism. it'll get in there and take.
Over. And you look at those and say, well, God, look at that sedge growing over there. God, it looks just like a monkey grass. And of course, environmentally, it would be more
suitable. Much more better for
the Eurasian species.
We've talked about the models that people have in their minds about what a garden should be and what it should look like. And you have the garden where you have a plant, and then 6 inches away another plant, and 6 inches away another plant, and mulch in between. But that sort of system does not occur in nature.
No, it does not.
And so when you try to impose that upon a place and call it a garden, you're pushing it. All those places in nature would have something in between growing, I'm saying.
There's been some great books put out lately about this whole idea of natural designing, of the native plants. And the natural designing is that, just go out in nature anywhere in the Mid-South and walk into the woods and look at the forest floor, okay? You're going to see a mosaic. And except for when a tree falls, okay, it is plant to plant, okay? You'll see a lot of different ground covers, but it's not going to be one solid mass like, the winter creeper that we see, the Eurasian vinca minor, that's been used here so much, English ivy as a ground cover.
Right.
You don't see that monoculture. Well, one of the catchwords here lately has been biodiversity. Okay, what is biodiversity? Well, go out there and look at all the different plants in a square meter. Okay. And count how many different species. Dr. Estes talks about a lot about in a prairie system, how many different species in a square meter in a prairie, okay? And he gets up 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 different species. And in the woods, on the forest floor, you don't have as much of the different species, but you do have a lot of different, that work together. And one plant is not necessarily so aggressive to crowd out the other plant. And that's where we notice these natives have been living together for a long time. And we don't see that happening as much. So what we're really talking about now is, with this looking at what's been going on for a long time out in nature, how do we take that and put that into our own backyard? And, you got to be careful with that, because some plants don't want to be over-cultivated. They, the reason that they're staying put in those natural areas is that they're not in a worked, cultivated bed, okay? So I tell a lot of my clients now is that, okay, don't worry about a lot of soil amendment if you're doing this or you're doing the sedges. Don't worry about it. What we don't want is too much aggressiveness, okay? We want them to kind of work together. And if they do, are you, psychologically, are you ready to handle that? And I think that what you talked about, how we used to measure these plants out, you know, right. And they had to be soldiers in a row and everything. You know, the gardener, the average backyard gardener, gosh, they have changed. It's just, and I think it's such, I am so thankful to watch this happen in my lifetime, okay, is that, you know, your suburban gardener is saying, you know, I don't know that I want to do it this way anymore. And we've been doing it for that way for, decades. And it's like, okay, I'm not sure I want to do it this way. I just don't know what to do because we were born and raised with that.
And so, Mike, the grasses present a whole array of opportunities for low-growing, high-growing, shade-growing, sun-growing, moist soil, dry soil types. I mean, the whole array is available to the grower, the gardener, even as far as decorative elements in terms of color and even shades of green and red and da da da.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about some of that. And the listener may want to get a pen and pencil to write down some of Mike's favorite suggestions. So let's start with the ground cover.
Okay.
Suppose we have a need for a ground cover in a somewhat shaded area. Where are you going to go for that?
Well, you know, and you, one of the words you mentioned just then is available. And I think now, if you look at the availability, there's a much more available. There's a grower up in New Jersey that a good friend of ours that we work with, a New Moon Nursery, and he has brought the sedges out into the more of the mainstream for the rest of us to get, you know, the plugs and grow them out. So we're seeing now how these will work. We watched them in nature. Sure, they do great now. We can watch them in under cultivation. I have to say, for ground covers, especially for the shady areas, it's hands down the sedges. And there's every kind of texture you can imagine. If you want them to stay in place more, there's species that are clumpers. If you want them to spread more as a ground cover, there are species that are spreaders. And but my favorite, I have to say, of the sedges, my favorite has been Cherokeeansis. Mm-hmm. And I think you have some in your yard.
We have some in our yard, yes.
And I think the reason I like it so much, it has a persistence into the winter, okay? So you've got that green texture. It is a bold plant.
It's kind of like the monkey grass substitute.
Right, exactly. And it can spread.
Yes.
And you can divide it. So if you don't like where it's going this way, pop it up, divide it, put it in another area. But it really works. And it seems, because it gets up to about 8, 9, 10 inches mm-hmm. tall, the foliage, and it lays down a little bit, which I like that relaxed look with the blades of grass, of the sedge. But you're getting a little habitat with that, too. There's birds that will get in underneath that. So you get a little habitat with the Carex Cherokeeansis.
And it really does cover the floor.
It does.
And in a way that inhibits other, let's just call them weeds, for lack of a better term.
Right.
And so it makes a low-maintenance shaded area, really.
Right. Right. So the ground covers, you know, I mean, you don't see in the native grass world, you don't see as many ground covers in sun, because that's where we're talking about, you know, other flowering plants, coneflowers, rebeccias, black-eyed susans, you know, have to be in with that too. Mm-hmm. In the shady areas, you're going to see more of those native, we're calling grasses, of course,
right.
Which more of the sedges. You get a little bit more height, bottle brush grass. The Elemis hystrix is a beautiful grass for shade. And you're going to talking about, you know, 2 to 3 feet out of that. What I love about the bottle brush grass is that it produces this bottle brush look, seed head, late summer into the fall, and it moves with the wind, okay? So if you got a little breezy, so that's a good back of the border plant for that. I hesitate sometimes to talk about river oats because, you know, if you put river oats in the wrong spot, it can be a little aggressive. You put river oats in shade and it's not as aggressive. So I've used it a lot in shady areas. Now, ground cover is a relative thing, okay?
Sure.
If it covers the ground at 2 feet tall, it can be still a ground cover.
Okay.
You know, we think of ground covers as being 1 foot or less.
Sure.
Those are good shade grasses. For the sun, it's a whole new world. And Mark, you don't have enough time on this podcast for me to talk about all that. I am crazy about these grasses. They're just these native grasses. And I think what I really like about the sun grasses, we'll call them the prairie grasses,
okay.
Prairie remnants, is that the movement they have, okay? You get one that's 3 to 4 feet tall on a breezy day in the fall or even in dead in the winter, and look at the movement they have. You know, you look at fields of wheat, you know, in the wind, what it does with the movement of fields of wheat, and you say, how romantic that is, that's beautiful, you know. You could do that with your grasses, okay? Now, one native grass in a landscape, it's okay, mass them. Put masses in, and that way you see that movement all through the winter. And you're talking about right up until, you know, March, you know, through the winter. And you're not going to have blooming. You're not going to have, you know, maybe there's not a lot of evergreen in your landscape, especially in a prairie system, you know, kind of planting, butterfly garden. But you see that movement.
So we have, in our garden, we've had switchgrass of a couple different varieties. And it's like 6 feet tall,
mm-hmm.
And our soils are deep here. I guess it doesn't always get quite that tall, but sometimes it flops over too, but it is a backdrop,
yep.
For our garden, even in the wintertime when it's brown, it's not a green thing, but it does add a little interest.
Yeah, it does. And one of the things I love to do is, and you know, we're talking about the panicum, the red switchgrass. There's one called North Wind, mm-hmm. And it's a very stately, upright growing. Talking about these plants, whether they're non-native, native grasses or forbs or whatever, you don't want them just to survive. You want them to perform.
Okay.
And one of the things we notice about, you know, these switchgrasses is that they tend to flop if they're not in the most perfect conditions. Well, what is a perfect condition for a red switchgrass? Hot, dry, full sun, nasty conditions, lean soil. Not necessarily something we always have in our suburban landscape. So North Wind has been really the best performer of these Panicum virgatums, the red switchgrasses, because it does stand up better. And I love taking those and putting something with red berries in the dead of the winter. Let's talk about the grasses for when they're the most beautiful. Dead of the winter, okay? Sure, you get some fall color on some of these. Some of these have great blooms in the end of the summer. But, you know, grasses in the dead of the winter. And then if I could take something and have something with red berries, like a small winter berry that shows mm-hmm. up against mm-hmm. that, I saw in your landscape you have coral berry, you know, mm-hmm. the Stemplocarpus orbiculatus. You have that in your landscape, and those berries showing up against the grasses, or just a seed head of a coneflower showing up. So I like what you're talking about. It's a backdrop. It's
right.
A good plant. You know?
Right.
So the sun grasses in the past 10 years have just taken on a whole new world.
So blue stem, the big blue stem and the little blue stem, is the classic prairie species,
right.
In Tennessee and throughout this area of the South.
Right.
Are there cultivars that are used or native species that are used in gardening?
Yeah. And you know, if you go out into a prairie system and look at the two blues, okay, the big blue stem and the little blue stem. look at the how variable, how many different shades of blue. How many, and even in the fall, you get this orangey red color to the stem. Look at the colors, and you say, okay, now I know why there could be selections of these. And if you go into a prairie system and see thousands of plants, yeah, you're going to see a lot of different selections. This one's bluer than this one.
Right. Okay?
So out of all of that, people have made some great selections. And when we take a new grass or any new plant, period, that someone says, Mike, this is the greatest thing since the wheel, you're going to love it, we're going to trial it out for a few years. So from our trials, there is one that's been around for a while called the Blues. And we're talking Schizacrium scoparium, the Blues. That's a little blue stem. You're talking about, you know, 3 to 4 feet on that, but a really beautiful powder blue through the summer. And then as those stems get up into the fall, that also has that powder blue. So that's a really good performer for us. And it's been around for a while, so the availability should be. There is some new ones that are known for their red fall color, Standing Ovation is probably my favorite. I love using it on green roof applications. Mm-hmm. It doesn't get as tall, but as the foliage, and what we're talking about, these stems, okay, on the little blue stem and big blue stem, that's the stems for the flowers,
right.
Okay? So as these flowering stems come up, they have red, really intense red. That came out of the Chicago area. It's been used for green roofs up there, and we're playing around with it a lot down here as well.
Chicago park districts have been doing a lot of conservation measures involving restoration of prairies.
Right. And there is a huge restored prairie up there that was an old soybean farm. And it's, I don't know, 1,000 acres easy. And they restored it into prairies. You know, you think about different areas around the country, and, you know, we talk about prairies. It's hard not to think about the Midwest and around Chicago. And there were some amazing prairies up there before development. And so they're doing restorations up there. Right. So there's a lot of growers up there that are into the prairie-type plants, okay? If you start growing a lot of these, you start saying, oh, wow, look at that one. That definitely looks different than these other 500 over here. Let's grow that one. Next thing you know, they put a name on it.
So, Mike, can the home gardener grow these sorts of grasses, let's say the blue stems, little blue stem, big blue stem. Can the home gardener grow those from seed?
They can. However, from seed, you're talking about a 3-year run.
Okay,
before they get into maturity. We know this because we've installed so many prairies. You know, one of the hot things that's happening in suburbia now is, you know, we can't do a prairie. You got a quarter acre lot. What are we really talking about, prairies of 100 acres, you know? No, we're talking pocket prairies. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with a pocket prairie, you're talking about, well, for one big thing, is you're cutting back on the turf grass.
Right.
And you're putting these prairie-type plants in a planting, not feeding it. You keep it very lean. You're talking about zero escaping, keeping the water away from it according to what kind of plants you're putting in. But with these pocket prairies, they're low maintenance, okay? If you do it from seed, you got to wait 3 years to get a plug size, and that's not a mature.
And keep the weedy other things out of it.
Right, so it becomes a maintenance issue. And then the other alternative is to put it in as plugs. You're talking about 2 years on that, or you're talking about 1 gallons or 3 gallons, and then you've got an instant landscape.
Well, so, and then you've got a huge expense.
You're spending more money, but you got to weigh out, well, how much sweat equity am I willing to put in
yes.
with those when I'm putting in the seed? So seed is it's a good way to do it. If you're talking about designing in, you know, because our landscapes, we don't go out there in our landscapes and, you know, in your yard, I've noticed how the flow of some of these. If you threw seed out there, you would not have that same form and flow.
Right.
So we're talking about designing. When you're talking about designing, it's hard to design with seed. Seed's going to do whatever it wants to do.
Right.
You're not going to go out there and just put a little bit of seed in like corn crop. So that's where plugs will come in. And with plugs, you know, you're talking about, you know, $2.50 to $3 a plug. 1 gallons, you're talking about $10 plus on a gallon and then more. But you get to design that in. Now, if you allow it to reseed itself, and I've had a lot of clients to do that, it's not bad looking at all, but at least you started off with the form.
Right.
If you want to keep the integrity of that design in, you're going to have to go out there and pull out some of those seedlings from some of these native grasses where they've tried to reseed themselves. We see this a lot. We did a big green roof in Franklin years ago, and we put the pink muley grass, the Muhlenbergia capillaris. You have that in your yard. Mm-hmm. Great grass. And we actually put it in a form, okay, with other flowering plants like Tennessee coneflower, prairie clovers, some asters, things like that. We put it all in a design. It did not take but just a couple of years where the muley grass, the pink muley grass, reseeded itself and just kind of went everywhere. So, you know, is it a green roof? Yes. Is it functional as a green roof? Sure, you got a good green cover. Is the integrity of the designs? In other words, do you have a good complement of flowering plants next to this grass? No, because the muley grass overtook. So you got to be careful with that. You look at them in the wild, where they occur, and you see, oh, there's a little pocket there, there's a few over there. It's because there's competition from other plants. Mm-hmm. Coming in. Mm-hmm. And in our landscapes, we don't necessarily have all that competition. So, you know, caution with that, you know, especially when they start reseeding themselves. You know, be selective. I like this coverage. Okay, well, how much do you like that coverage, and to the point that it may compete against some of these other plants, like coneflower. Purple coneflower likes a little more open, doesn't like as much competition, you know, so.
I've had coneflowers be pushed out of the garden by aggressive other plants. So yes, exactly. So what about moist areas for grasses?
Yeah, I soft rush to me is just, it's a beautiful thing. Juncus confusus. Juncus effusus. So it's an evergreen stem wetland plant. We used it in rain gardens, Arlington Agriculture. We some huge rain gardens in over there years ago, and we used a lot of that soft rush in there. So you, in the snow on the ground, you'll see that evergreen stand up. Drought tolerance, no. And we're talking wetland species.
Right.
And, you know, so rain gardens are really hot now, and bioretention, especially around Nashville, you know, we've got to do something about our stormwater. So
being required,
yeah. Codes is really hot on this. And I'm glad that they're being aggressive, the stormwater people here in Metro Nashville, and is that, you know, we got to put do something about the stormwater. Well, when you're talking rain gardens, okay, well, that means plants in these bioretention basins. And what are the plants that can handle those conditions? Because you're talking about 24 hours of wet. We get a 6-inch event. You're talking about a lot of wet.
Yeah.
Okay. And then at the same time, if we go 30 days without rain, we're talking about drought tolerance too. And I have used a soft rush. I've used the panicums, the red switchgrass. So, if you're talking about 7 days a week of wet, okay, there are just there's actually some sedges that work. The Carex stricta, which is a beautiful thing, has a crazy star-shaped seed head, does great in wetland conditions. The juncus, the only thing that I've had that would outcompete in a juncus a soft rush was the horsetail grass, okay, which is not really a grass, it's a fern ally. And as soon as I mentioned some of that, scouring rush, some people call it, as soon as I mentioned that, there's some people out there that had it and say, whoa, careful. You know,
that can be very aggressive.
Especially in moist areas,
right,
you know, which is where it would naturally occur. So,
you know, there's somebody has done a planting around the Byright store on Belmont Avenue over here close to us. And they have a little area. It's almost like a concrete planter.
Yeah.
And they have a planting of that scouring horsetail.
Uh-huh.
And it's extraordinarily pretty.
Yeah.
But it's well contained.
Yeah, that's the only way I would apply it. Yeah, you know, Oak Ridge, I remember being up there years ago at the laboratory, and they tried to do all native up there, and they had planter boxes with possum hole hollies growing out of, and these were 4 feet tall with about a 5 to 6 foot width on square boxes, and inside that those planters, they put horsetail grass, the scouring rush, and they would cut it. And you could almost put a bowling ball on top of that. It was so thick and so dense and so strong to support that bowling ball. But architecturally, it was beautiful.
Yeah, really pretty.
Because it is an evergreen, and it is persistent. You know, so the only thing about that is talk about aggressiveness and how it competes with. Be careful where you put that.
Right, right. You know, you and I had a conversation some years ago before I retired from my law practice about neighbor suing neighbor over invasive bamboo. Do you remember that conversation that we had? I think that there are people that will still want to plant that bamboo.
Yeah. And you know, there is, talking about grasses.
Right.
There is Arundinaria gigantea. That is our native river cane. And people say, well, that's bamboo. Well, it's a grass to me. Okay.
Right.
Bamboo is a grass.
Right.
And if you look at the cane brakes that have been here for 1,000 years around Middle Tennessee, and you know the Caney Fork River.
It is Kentucky.
Exactly. So these were massive cane, river cane colonies. And, you hear all kinds of stories of how the Native Americans actually use these big cane brakes to corral bison into, and, would burn out the centers because they were so thick. We don't see that anymore. I am getting calls for that river cane to be put in the landscape. It's not going to be as aggressive as the Asian bamboo. It doesn't get as big, it's a little bit more of the monoculture. It will spread, but not as aggressively. If you're looking for screening, when we talk about grasses, a lot of times especially in full sun areas, I'll use some of these red switchgrass varieties like Cloud 9 as a screening plant, through the summer, because they grow up so quickly after you cut them in the spring. River cane is a good screening plant, not as aggressive. So if you're talking about, I've got a little patience, Mike, I can wait. Sure, we'll put in a few of those and let that gradually spread.
Have a little bit of a moist environment for that, I wonder.
Moist environment, we've experimented with those in more sun, and if you've got some rich soil, this is where you're going to do a little different. If you're talking about compost type soil, and many of us do composting, if you're doing something like that, they can handle more of the sun. Okay, so if you're putting in a dry condition, a little bit more of the shade. So, what you want is to never give it hot, dry, full sun.
Okay.
So that means, I've got a moist area over here. This happens to be sunny. They'll do great. I've got a shade area over here that's a little more on the dry side. Sure, they'll be fine.
I've never seen someone actually... I've never seen that in anyone's garden or around anyone's house, the river cane.
I think you're going to. I think that's what people are starting to, this whole native plant movement, people are now just coming in and say, show me natives. Mm-hmm. It used to be, I want to see something pretty. Now it's like, I want to put my yard back the way it was 200 years ago.
Right.
And it's, Mark, it's been fun because people are saying, we have, at the nursery, we have an endangered species permit, and people will come in and ask for, I want one of those federally protected plants. They don't have to have a special permit like I do to grow and sell it. They can buy those plants, and what they're realizing is that they're tough, they're durable, and they're user-friendly in their landscapes with other plants, and just happen to be endangered.
Our friend Dwayne Estes is trying to encourage people to study the history of the landscape and what was here prior to settlement.
Right.
The myth, he talks about the myth of the squirrel and the idea that there was this landscape here was covered from point to point with all forest, and that's just not so.
That was not true.
you know, recently he posted something about a Metro Park that was had a remnant of a Chinkapin and McGregor rye savanna. And I thought to myself, that's exactly what I have here on this little hilltop here in Nashville.
Exactly.
With the Chinkapin, not the Chinkapin, yes, the Chinkapin
yeah,
oak.
Chinkapin oak, yeah.
So let's talk about the ryegrass, the native ryes.
Yeah, I love the ryes. And we're introducing more new ryes now. And again, what I like about ryegrasses is that they fill a niche. They get a little bit more height to them. They have a seed head that's just absolutely beautiful. And, you know, Canada rye, Virginia rye, and then there's a lot of, you know, I mentioned the bottle brush grass. That is a ryegrass.
Okay.
So what the ryegrasses are known for, and they're cool season grasses, okay? So you'll see evergreen basal growth of the leaf at the bottom. You'll see that through the winter, okay, with the ryegrasses. But the seed heads are absolutely beautiful. So this flow, this movement that we're talking about in sun grasses, this is where you get that in the shade, okay, is that movement of those seed heads. The birds will gradually get to them, okay, so it's habitat. I like the ryegrasses. You can get a lot more drought tolerance with their ryes. Most of those.
Are we talking about straight species with these plants?
There's really not, in my that I know of, any cultivars of the elements of the mm-hmm. ryegrasses. Mm-hmm. You're going to find and there's not any, maybe one or two cultivars of the sedges. When it comes to the shade plants, you're not seeing. You know, they're good performers on their own. It's when we see the colors on the sun grasses where we start talking about cultivars.
More cultivars.
And again, in my opinion, the straight species, a little blue stem and big blue stem, it's they're beautiful plants.
Right.
Our prairies that we have, we've got about 60 acres on the prairie there around the nursery. And we look at those, and again, how different they are from plant to plant to plant. And some of these are just drop dead gorgeous. They're beautiful in the fall. Big blue stem, you know, we didn't talk much about that. Andropogon glomeratus or Girardia. You want to be a little selective about where you put them because they do stand up, get up big. Okay.
How big?
Oh gosh, I've got some that are 8 feet tall.
Okay.
Every bit.
Okay.
Yeah. And you know, it's also called turkey foot because if you look at the seed head, it's got the 3.3 legs on a foot, three toes on a foot, kind of turkey foot shape, but stately, strong growers. So the big blue stem, little blue stem, you're going to find a lot more selections. The red switchgrass, I would say, of these three, what I call the three big grasses, the little blue stem, big blue stem, and red switchgrass, there's more varieties of red switchgrass. And a lot of these has nothing to do with the color. It has a lot to do with the size and structure of the plant. Like I said, the north wind, 6 feet tall. You can get Shenandoah, which is about a 3 foot tall plant. And I'll tell you something else, Mark. Some of these new, what we call new to us, that's coming out of the west and the midwest, the southwest, the side oaks, grama, Botalua gracilis, that is a beautiful, more of a western species that does great for us here. Some of these grasses from the deep south, you know, muley grass at one time was iffy here because our winters were so hard and the muley grasses were treated as an annual.
Right.
You know.
And this is the beautiful grass that's has the colloquial name pink hair grass.
Pink hair grass, right. pink muley grass, right. Muhlenbergia capillaris. And speaking of the pink, if you want something to spread a little bit in your sunny area and only get a foot tall, and I love the common name of this, love grass, Aragrostis spectabilis. And it's kind of cool that it has this pink muley grass kind of flower to it, but only a foot tall. And what it will do when it's ready to reseed itself, it will dehisce or separate off. And like tumbleweed, it spreads according to the wind, blowing it around. So you see it in natural areas where the lovegrass are long masses, and you can pretty much guess which the prevailing winds have carried it. And you'll see that pink hue in the late summer. Tough, tough plant. And I don't know why it's called lovegrass. It's one of the toughest grasses I know of. But, you know, I think that's where the grass is becoming more popular, just not because they're pretty and you know, they're adaptable, but they are tough. If you put the right grasses in the right spot, they are tough, tough plants.
Fantastic. Mike, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure to get back with you, and hope we'll get together soon. It won't be 2 years between now and the next time we get together.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you for listening to the Mark Fraley Podcast. If you've liked what you've heard, please be sure to subscribe to our feed on iTunes Podcasts and to like us on Facebook. Thank you.